A longtime Valley company is washing its hands of the city. But a former executive says the decision's been bubbling for a while.
It makes me disappointed, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise me. It's a continuation of things that began all nearly a decade ago.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Phoenix votes not to cut funding for Valley Metro. Arizona gets a record amount of money to pay for placement tests.
A two-mile stretch of Tucson is one of the most endangered places in the country.
And using the sense of touch for communication.
What does the body do best? The body feels information. It's feeling the surrounding temperature. It's feeling the textures of the things that you touch.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic on the 101 southbound in the East Valley. A crash at Broadway has traffic slowing in that area. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 90 degrees. Clear tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-60s. Sunny and 95 for a high tomorrow. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, it's 84 degrees. Affordable housing for female veterans and their families is scarce in the Valley, but Tempe hopes to open a development to meet more of those needs. Tempe is building an affordable housing development for female veterans and their families on 8th Street east of Rural Road. In collaboration with Save the Family, the facility will provide space for 50 low-income families. Save the Family will provide on-site resources, including health care and job searching services. After-school care and tutoring will be provided for the kids. A garden and playground area will also be built. Vice Mayor Robin Arredondo Savage says the new facility is expected to open in fall of 2017 and was funded by the federal government, the county, and the nonprofit Save the Family.
It was really, truly a collaborative effort, and we're really excited about the people that we're going to be able to help and the lives that we're going to be able to change.
Veterans can start applying for admission through the city or through Save the Family.
It's so crowded around restaurants at Sky Harbor's busiest terminal that the airport is now working with the businesses to improve customer service. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on plans for Terminal 4.
Airport leaders want to add four locations described as grab and go, small spaces at the beginning of the concourse where you can buy drinks and prepackaged food. Councilwoman Thelda Williams supports more options. During Wednesday's Aviation Subcommittee meeting, she talked about her recent experience.
It was so packed, you couldn't get coffee. It was a miserable time waiting to take a flight.
If the full council approves, the grab-and-go locations will replace news racks, which would move to other areas in Terminal 4. The new food spaces are expected to generate more than $6 million in annual sales. Based on industry standards, Sky Harbor estimates it's short more than 40,000 square feet of food and beverage space. Airport staff will also work with restaurants to improve the way people wait in line and make sure they have enough employees during peak periods. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Henkel, the German company that bought the Valley-based soap and consumer products-focused Dial Corporation in 2003, will be moving all of its operations out of Arizona beginning early next year. That will lead to a loss of 375 jobs, but also some of the Valley's history and a company that for decades was one of the most civically engaged entities here. Brad Casper was president and CEO of Dial from 2005 to 2010, and he's with me to talk about the Henkel move. Brad, what's your reaction to the news?
It makes me disappointed, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise me. It's a continuation of things that began all nearly a decade ago, where there was almost a minimizing of the influence and presence in Arizona, and a penchant for trying to shift more of the responsibility, more of the control, either back to Dusseldorf or to Connecticut.
How big an impact do you think the company did have over those years? And are we going to be missing something greater, or because of what you've described, you know, is it really not as big a deal as some people like me are making it?
At one level, from an economic impact on the Valley standpoint, it's probably not as great as you might think. I learned today through the media that the headcount that might be impacted in Arizona is now under 400. That's 50 to 75% less than it was when I was the CEO there in 2010. I feel horrible for the employees, many who have either moved here or been a large part of this company for decades. And this was one of the few large consumer-centric, or what we used to call CPG, consumer packaged goods, companies in the Valley. There aren't going to be as many opportunities for people from Dial. I said to one of my former colleagues in a text, I don't know how the market will be able to absorb this much talent in a sector that doesn't have a lot of other companies that really need that talent right now in our makeup.
And it's a company that, again, for a long time was a really good civic partner. I think it had that reputation as
yes.
well. How do you think does the Valley need more of that?
I think that's an excellent point. When I became CEO in April of 2005, my vice president of corporate affairs, public affairs, you know, asked me, well, Brad, what are you going to stand for? And I go, what do you mean? What am I going to stand for? I'm going to be the CEO of Dial. And she says, no, you have to understand there is a legacy at Dial that the CEO position commits to meaningful change in the community and commits to spending our corporate dollars and our philanthropy in ways that make a difference. And I embrace that dearly. And you know, education was one of many things that I happened to champion. I believe that Henkel's role and Dial's visibility over the past several years has been significantly less than, call it, you know, the 40 years prior, going back to the 70s through 2010. But I do think that was part of Henkel's plan, is to, you know, kind of pull back and make it less the heartbeat or a centerpiece of the city. When we were building that headquarter in circa 06, 07, 08, et cetera, it was the farthest thing from our minds that we would someday leave. That was supposed to be the anchor that kept us here indefinitely.
Brad Casper is a former president and CEO of Dial. Henkel, its parent company, is moving all Arizona-based positions out of state beginning next year. Dial's been in the Valley since the 1970s.
A golden parachute or a good deal for taxpayers? Those are the very different descriptions being used to describe a settlement deal with the former CEO of Valley Metro. During last night's special meeting of the Phoenix City Council, three members pressed for the city to cut its funding to the agency that runs buses and light rail. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes joins me to discuss the council's vote and what led up to it. And Christina, why did those council members want to cut that funding?
Well, Councilman Sal DeCicio proposed a motion to cut the city's payment to Valley Metro by nearly $65,000. That would have covered Phoenix's share of the settlement paid to Steve Banta.
What's the issue with Banta? Why did he leave Valley Metro?
He resigned late last year amid allegations that he improperly spent public money. The Arizona Republic reported Banta used Valley Metro funds to wine and dine his contacts and repeatedly flew himself and his wife to Portland at public expense. That's where they reportedly kept a second home. The paper's investigation led Phoenix Councilwoman Felda Williams, who sits on a Metro board, to call for an audit.
Well, what did that audit reveal?
More than $270,000 in questionable spending. Former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith is serving as Metro's interim CEO. Here's how he broke it down to the Phoenix Council.
The auditors classified $41,000 as unallowable expenses and $231,000 as undetermined expenses. Undetermined due to missing or confusing documentation or questions involving the interpretations in Banta's employment contract.
And Banta's contract is the key to this whole thing. Basically, it says he'll be reimbursed for work-related travel, lodging, and meals. So does that mean he can or he should fly first class, stay in a $600-a-night hotel room, or buy alcohol, as the Republic reported?
Well, Christina, wasn't there also an issue with who actually wrote the contract?
Yeah, it was put together by Valley Metro's in-house attorney. So he wrote his boss's contract. Many will agree that's awkward, if not unethical. We're told that will not happen with the next CEO's contract, that Metro will have an outside attorney work it up. and use more specific language.
And speaking of language, some of it sounds like got pretty heated last night.
It did. Councilwoman Williams, along with her fellow Metro board members, agreed to settle with Banta, but she was not happy about it.
I think his performance clearly demonstrated the lack of professionalism, ethical behavior, and leadership, and quite frankly, he was despicable.
Just as unhappy was Councilman Sal DeCiccio. He's the one that pushed the council to cut its funding to Valley Metro. He says Metro's deal with Banta just shows why taxpayers don't trust government leaders.
They see the people at the top getting treated better. That's what's happening here. You got people at the very top, and you have all these lawyers coming around saying, oh, yeah, he has to be treated differently.
Now, DeCiccio's attempt to cut the city's funding to Valley Metro failed. So what will Banta actually get?
DeCiccio calls it a golden parachute because Metro is releasing a block it had on Banta's annuity, which was part of his compensation. It was valued at more than $300,000. Banta now gets that money, but Metro lawyers say the agency's getting something too. Out of his annuity, Banta will pay $125,000 for unauthorized expenses.
So does this mark the end of this saga?
Well, on the civil side, it seems to be over. Neither Metro nor Banta admit wrongdoing, and the deal also means Banta won't try to sue Valley Metro. However, the Attorney General's office is still investigating possible criminal misconduct.
That's KJZZ's Christina Estes. Thanks, Christina.
You're welcome.
The U.S. Education Department is sending Arizona more than $648,000 to help defray the cost for low-income students to take advanced placement or AP exams. The state's been receiving this grant since 2003, but this year's amount is the most it's ever gotten. Officials say since they started getting this money, the number of tests it's helped pay for has risen from less than 1,000 to more than 16,000. Peter Lang is Senior Director for Advanced Placement Programs at the Arizona Department of Education. And Peter, who exactly qualifies for these grants?
The students that qualify for this program are those that qualify for the Federal Free and Reduced Price Meal Program. So they are primarily low-income students or students that come from low-income families.
Do we know how many of them are currently taking AP classes?
We do to an extent. So I'm gonna answer that in two ways. We have some data that we're still awaiting. So what I can share is that for this last administration cycle, so these dollars are helping to offset the costs for exams taken during the 15-16 school year. So the majority of these exams were taken in spring 2016, or this last spring. So we had 16,364 exams, AP exams, that qualified for the fee waiver this past year across 157 schools. Also, the program helps to offset costs for two other programs, the International Baccalaureate Program and the Cambridge International Examination Program.
How much does an AP exam cost to take these days?
So the cost for per AP exam for 2016 was $92 per exam. So the College Board actually provides a waiver of $26. Then there's also a local waiver from the school of $8. And at the end of the day, we also ask for a local contribution per exam of $15. So that's the actual cost that's either borne by the student, the family, or the school through a fundraising process.
I would imagine for some families, even $15 is still a pretty sizable amount. Do you think that this waiver helps students who otherwise wouldn't be able to take AP exams to be able to afford to take them?
Absolutely. I would say that this has been one of the most powerful incentives to help ensure access and success for students across the state, and in particular our low-income students, to be able to take the most rigorous program that's offered in high school, which is the Advanced Placement Program. And so this has been a primary driver in terms of helping to realize our shared goal of ensuring that kids are prepared for whatever choices that they seek after high school. By taking these rigorous programs in high school, not only are they better prepared, but it's also saving them money.
Are you satisfied with the robustness of AP offerings in schools in which a lot of the students that qualify for free and reduced lunch and are also qualifying for this fee waiver for AP exams?
I would preface by saying that we have more students, low-income students, earning a 3, 4, or 5 today than the total number of students that took exams 10 years ago.
And AP exams, so, just to clarify, are based on a 5-point scale.
Yes, exactly. So students earning a 3 or higher, that typically translates either into advanced standing or direct credit from a college or university. So as I said, we have more students, more low-income students earning a 3 or higher than the total number of students that sat for exams 10 years ago. So that's a tremendous accomplishment. It's something that we should be proud of. However, at the same time, we know that we have a lot of work to do. We can certainly increase our efforts collectively to ensure that more students have access to these types of programs and opportunities, because we know that it can help unlock doors of potential for these students and can actually change lives.
Has there also been an increase in Arizona over the past number of years of the number of courses that are being offered at the AP level?
That's a great question. And a matter of fact, we will have better access to that data starting this year. I will say, just based on my experience and what we've seen through other data sources, yes, we have seen an expansion in programs that are being offered and expansion in new schools that have been offering programs that maybe they haven't in the past. And a great tool that's helped to support that has been programs like this that has helped to offset that cost, which is a very real thing for a student or for a family, to be able to sit for the exam.
Peter Lang is the Senior Director of Advanced Placement Programs with the Arizona Department of Education. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, a stretch of Tucson gets a dubious historic preservation designation that may turn out to be good news.
By being very proactive in the approach, we think that there's actually a solution here that could result in retaining that sense of place and that sense of mid-century corridor.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark. I'm Steve. Valley weather for the rest of today. We're expecting to stay mostly sunny, a little bit breezy. Look for a high temperature around 89. Then for tonight, clear skies, lows in the mid-60s, sunny and warmer tomorrow with a high of 95. And then a chance for rain comes our way on Friday night. It's a 30% chance. Look for lows in the mid-70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 25%, and under partly cloudy skies, 84 degrees at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Desert Schools Federal Credit Union, a locally owned lender offering a personalized approach for commercial real estate loans to help grow your business. Learn more at desertschools.org/business.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
With all of the mystery of a papal elevation, the United Nations Security Council, along with Russia and the United States, agreed unanimously to appoint Portugal's Antonio Guterres as the next UN Secretary General. The former Prime Minister of Portugal has served as High Commissioner for the UN Refugee Agency for the past decade. A formal vote will ratify the nomination, and Guterres will become the 9th UN Secretary General, meaning once again, the Secretary General will not be a woman. Dr. Jean Krasno is a former executive director of the Academic Council on the UN system and is currently a tenured lecturer at the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership at the City College of New York. Even though this year the UN tried to make the replacement of Ban Ki-moon more like a traditional open ballot, Jean Krasno says an opportunity was missed.
We are just terribly disappointed that it's not a woman.
How does the process work here? It doesn't seem like it's an elective position. It's more like appointed by some big shots at the UN.
This particular year for the election of the Secretary General, it has been more transparent. Prior to this, it was completely secretive. Nobody knew anything until the final name was announced. But the General Assembly last year demanded to have a greater role. And so they passed a resolution saying candidates should be nominated by countries and that all candidates would have an open hearing at the UN. And that has happened. So we've been able to meet all the candidates. There have been 13, 7 women, 6 men. And it's been a great experience for the women to get to be known by the public, to express their ideas, and for us to see how outstanding they are. However, they didn't prevail.
What did you advocate as far as having a woman be Secretary General, and who were the candidates?
our purpose was to get a woman elected. So we were not backing any particular woman because, as we saw when the process evolved, some women dropped out. A new candidate came on just last week. So we felt that we had to stay open in terms of who it would be. But we felt very strongly that the UN is now 71 years old. There had never been a woman secretary general. There have been 8 men. They've all been very good. I have no problem with that. But women make up more than half the world's population, and they have not had a voice at the top.
Although beyond that, isn't it also the case that the UN deals with, in a lot of its cultural and health-related programs, issues of great importance to women all around the world, and that to not have a woman at that sort of senior level is an omission at this point, as opposed to purely just balancing the ticket?
Absolutely. It's not just a matter of gender equity, which is, of course, something that we advocate, but women are refugees. They have to take care of their families, their children. They're fleeing awful conflicts or earthquakes, and there's no one to listen to their needs. And we envisioned a woman secretary general going around the world, visiting parliaments, visiting villages, visiting refugee camps, and sitting down and listening to what women needed. And then also saying, you also can be a part of the decision-making process. I'm here to show you that you can, as women, do that. And now we've missed that.
Critics of Ban Ki-moon and some of the more recent secretaries general have said that the profile has not been high enough to deliver the power that the UN needs to have to move the needle in countries around the world where, as you say, the refugee crisis is a huge problem. Do you think it is the case? And can you give me an example of a woman who has the political oomph and stature to really raise the profile of the Secretary General like it was in the past, Dag Hammarskjöld, some of the characters who we know in history really were global figures?
Yes. I mean, I think the women candidates who got into the process, several of them were outstanding in that way. And what's frustrating is that women are held to a higher standard. And then they don't tell us what the standard is.
Who is someone that we should watch?
We felt that Irina Bokova, who is the Director General of UNESCO, was a fantastic candidate, and she was generally one of the higher women in these results, as there were 6 straw polls. And also the latecomer, Kristalina Georgieva, fantastic, brilliant, articulate, charismatic, and yet has this human quality to her.
Do you think that there was a veto here, that Bokova particularly was someone who the Russians would not have wanted, and that the U.S. compromised, and that there was some backroom deal?
There was definitely a backroom deal. I don't know what the backroom deal was, but Russia turned its back on its own region. It abandoned its own constituency, Eastern Europe. When I met with Ambassador Churkin about a year ago, he said, it has to be from Eastern Europe. And he gave me a list of every region that had been represented, and he absolutely pounded the table and said it has to be Eastern Europe. And then he didn't do it.
And how do you take this back to your academic responsibilities? Does this become a setback, you tell your students? Is this a bad moment in the history of the United Nations, or we just go on for another day?
Well, I've been teaching courses on the UN and international law for over 20 years. At Yale University, at City College, and I also teach at Columbia. It's reality. It's a reality check that there is still a lot of discrimination against women, that people don't believe that a woman can really be a leader. I mean, I'm firmly convinced that women can be wonderful leaders, but there's still a lot out there who don't believe that.
Jean Krasnow is a tenured lecturer at the Colin Powell School of Civic and Global Leadership at City College here in New York, former executive director of the Academic Council on the United Nations System. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at our partner, The Takeaway.
When you think about Arizona history, what comes to mind? Gunfights at the OK Corral, copper mining towns, missionaries, cowboys? Well, there's another side to those stories, and tomorrow, historians and researchers will gather in the Valley to highlight Arizona women's history. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with one of the historians, and she joins us now. And Lauren, what will they be covering tomorrow?
So the whole thing is focusing on women at work, and they're covering everything from Tohono O'odham women potters to women entrepreneurs in the brothel business. Their goal is to highlight that the fact that there actually is research being done on women in our state's history, and hopefully to encourage more of it. So I talked with Heidi O'Salier about the symposium. She's a historian, teacher, and a writer, and she'll be presenting on the women of Route 66 tomorrow. And I was curious about the assumptions we often make about women's roles in Arizona history.
We always assume, Arizona history is about cowboys and, you know, miners and ranching and things like that. But women were here too. And women often had to work because we were, in our early part of our history, a very poor state. A last state of the lower 48 to enter the Union. Also a place of a lot of poverty. And women, whether they were single, and there were a lot of widowed women here, higher than average numbers, a lot of divorced women, but also married women who had to go back to work in the teens, 20s, 30s, even after their children were born. That's where you see these stories in the mining camps on Route 66, even later. These women were married and had 3-4 children and had to go to work because their husbands couldn't make enough steady income to support their families.
So this wasn't the traditional women's role.
Way before the women's movement, women were in this state working outside the home. I'll give you a statistic from the early 1900s. The census tells us nationwide about 15% of married women worked outside the home. In Arizona, it was 40%. The economy was very much boom and bust, so women went back to teach school after they had their children. They took in boarders, they washed laundry, they ran restaurants, they did all kinds of things to put food on the table.
So I think in Arizona, you think especially about Arizona as like the Wild West. Mm-hmm. It's very masculine in lots of ways, I think, in terms of especially that mythological history that mm-hmm. we have here. So do you think it's important to sort of highlight women's stories within that?
I think what anyone attending this symposium will find listening is women worked in all kinds of industries. They were ranchers in the early days, but mostly they did the ancillary jobs, the support jobs. They were running boarding houses and they were running restaurants. You see a lot of lawyers here, a lot of women in politics. We've always been one of the top 3 or 4 states for female representation in politics ever since women got the right to vote in 1912.
So do you think women in Arizona history are often overlooked?
Yes, I think they are. And I think you're seeing a little bit more of an effort to incorporate them into our history courses and our history books, but it's been a long time coming.
So why do you think it's important to have symposiums like this to highlight women in our state's history?
Well, I think to show that there is a lot of research going on. It's very diverse. We're going to have a great panel on Native American women and the home economy on Friday. We're going to hear from Latino women and a very diverse group of voices that we really don't normally hear about. So I think those stories, I know I teach at ASU, Arizona History, and I always get people asking me, well, let's hear some more stories about the women.
So give us, before we go, one of your favorite stories about one of your favorite Arizona women that people don't know about.
Nellie Trent Bush was Arizona's admiral. Did you know we had an admiral?
No.
So she was the admiral of our Navy. In the 1930s, we were in some water wars with California. And our Arizona governor decided to shut down the Parker Dam construction. And Nellie Trent Bush and her husband Joe ran a ferry boat business on the river. She was one of the earliest female licensed riverboat pilots in the U.S. And she, on her little ferry boat, was taking National Guard's troops over to shut down construction. I don't think they got far, but it made national news. But she was just that kind of person that would just get in your face and say, what do you mean? We can't do it. Women can't do it.
All right. Well, Heidi O'Salier, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Lauren.
The Arizona Women's History Symposium is tomorrow at the Arizona Heritage Center at Papago Park.
To send something into space, the accepted technique is to launch it with a rocket. But in the 1960s, a Canadian visionary proposed a radical idea to simply shoot through the atmosphere with a giant space gun. From the Arizona Science Desk, Maya Springhawk-Robnett reports for KJZZ.
In the middle of the Arizona desert sits a large white cannon. It measures 122 feet long from breech to muzzle, and the barrel is 16 inches around. Wayne Shilders, the chief of the Weapons Operations Division for the Yuma Proving Ground, says this monster gun's barrel is actually two barrels from retired battleship cannons welded together.
The second half was built and welded on out of two different tubes. And, you know, they scrapped some of the ships and stuff like that, so chances are this might have came off one of the ships that was damaged.
The High Altitude Research Project, or HARP, was initially created to test the conditions of the upper reaches of Earth's atmosphere. The HARP program had three locations, one in Canada, one in Barbados, and a third at Yuma Proving Ground in Arizona. From 1966 to 69, the Yuma Proving Ground HARP gun was used for these atmospheric tests, shooting projectiles into the ionosphere to get readings. Through the 1980s and into the early 90s, it was used for other tests requiring large artillery. And Shilders, who worked with the gun from 1984 till its last shot in 92, says it was a sight to see. A fireball exploding from the barrel and a great deal of sound.
Even our normal artillery that we shoot now, and you can hear some of the guns going off in the back, you can hear these things all the way into town from here, which is, what, 17 to 20 miles? With this one here, you would hear it in town, no doubt.
The HARP gun at YPG set two world records in its short three-year run, the first for altitude. It shot up 111 miles high. The second was for the most gunpowder loaded into a gun, 1,225 pounds. Using the HARP gun to determine the nature of the upper atmosphere was kind of an afterthought. Bill Heidner, the museum curator of the U.S. Army Yuma Proving Ground Heritage Center, says NASA was set to share data from rocket launches, but...
The rockets were just blowing through the Earth's atmosphere at such a fast rate of speed, they weren't really gathering any data. So they looked at Dr. Bull's HARP gun and really thought, well, they can just kind of lob it up there at Apogee and have it just traveling through the ionosphere before it falls back to Earth. They could gather a significant amount of data.
Dr. Bull is Canadian scientist Gerald Bull of McGill University in Montreal, Canada. Bull gained an interest in artillery and ballistics, which developed into an unusual aim, to shoot satellites into orbit around Earth. Working with McGill, the Canadian government, and the U.S. Army, Bull began work on his HARP gun in the 1950s. Most scientists of the era thought he was insane, but Heidner says Bull didn't have much patience for what he called cocktail science, or mixing liquid fuels to launch rockets.
To him, the rest of the world, we were all fools.
Genius or not, Bull never finished his work. While offloading test equipment in the HARP Barbados location, his ship was found to be loaded with artillery ammunition destined for South Africa, which at the time was still under apartheid. Barbados brought the issue to the United Nations, and Bull's possessions in the U.S. and Canada were confiscated. The program was suspended, and Bull spent 6 months in U.S. federal prison. When Bull got out, he felt betrayed by the U.S. and Canadian governments and became an expert for hire for countries like Israel, South Africa, Britain, Australia, and Iraq, where he promised then-dictator Saddam Hussein that he could build Iraq a super cannon. This project, now referred to as Project Babylon, never came to fruition. Bull died in Brussels in 1990 in an apparent assassination. Heidner says Bull was still working on the Iraqi project.
And then 3 weeks later, Britain announced finding these sections of what supposedly was oil pipeline materials. But they looked at it and their experts said, no, this is way too robust for pipeline. This looks more like parts of a gun tube, perhaps a super cannon, which they were. They were part of Bull's Project Babylon.
It isn't known who assassinated Bull, though some speculate that it was either Israeli or British intelligence. The HARP gun still sits in the Arizona desert today. Heidner says it's still operational. For the Arizona Science Desk, I'm Maya Springhawk, Robnett.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Tickets for the game?
Tickets, you want to need them?
I'm Jillian Stachmus, and I'm here today for Family Weekend, and I'm a student here at Arizona State University. My parents came to visit me. We're just hanging out before the game. We're making some posters.
Gold. You want gold? Here you go.
We've been to every game. We actually got up around 7:30 this morning, and we got to the stadium to get our wristbands to get in the game today.
There's no rule book change. It still says, I mean the rule book, but there's a new criteria for loose interpretation.
It's just insane. Everyone's so together, and it's awesome. I mean, to like realize like, oh, like I'm just that little speck in like this giant crowd of people supporting our team.
That's Jillian Stachmas tailgating before an ASU football game. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to send us a locale brewski, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. Coming up, using the sense of touch for communication from your wrist, it's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Steve. I'm Mark. Checking Valley traffic, I-17 northbound. The Cactus Road exit ramp is restricted. 101 southbound in the East Valley, a crash at Broadway has traffic backed up. And another crash, I-10 westbound at Baseline. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today. Look for a high of 90 degrees. That would match yesterday's high. Clear skies for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-60s. Sunny and a bit warmer tomorrow with a high of 95. Down to 91 for a high on Saturday. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 17%. Sunny skies, 90 degrees at 2:40.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center. Presenting Bernadette Peters with the Phoenix Symphony, the 3-time Tony Award winner will perform songs from Gypsy, Into the Woods, and more. October 15th. Tickets at mesaartscenter.com.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Hurricane Matthew is gaining strength along Florida's Atlantic coast. It's grown into a dangerous Category 4 storm as the governor urges people to evacuate and prepare for the worst. There are now two hurricanes active in the Atlantic Ocean, but NPR's John Hamilton reports only one poses a threat to the U.S.
Government forecasters say an Atlantic storm named Nicole has strengthened into a Category 1 hurricane with winds of 80 miles per hour. Nicole is currently south of Bermuda and expected to remain hundreds of miles out to sea through the weekend. But forecasters say Hurricane Matthew, which was blamed for at least 100 deaths in Haiti, is gaining strength as it heads for the Florida coast. After weakening on Wednesday, Matthew is once again a Category 4 storm with winds near 140 miles per hour. Forecasters say Matthew is likely to produce hurricane-force winds along the southern Florida coast and could bring high winds and waves to the coasts of Georgia and South Carolina by Saturday. John Hamilton, NPR News.
A Pentagon investigation has found that a former military aide to the defense secretary abused his credit card privileges at strip clubs in Rome and Seoul. The report by the Defense Department's Inspector General says Major General Ron Lewis also lied to a bank to get credit card charges removed. Lewis was fired nearly a year ago by Defense Secretary Ash Carter. Lewis claims investigators built an inflammatory case against him based on innuendo. Fewer people sought unemployment benefits last week. Labor Department says weekly claims fell to 249,000, the lowest level since December 1973. Any weekly number below 300,000 suggests the job market is healthy. Unemployment claims have come in below that level for 83 straight weeks. Stocks finished mostly lower on Wall Street. The Dow fell 12 points, or 0.1%. This is NPR.
In KJZZ News at 2:42, the state's Department of Revenue laid off around 30 corporate auditors. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, there are now only four auditors responsible for making sure corporations pay what they owe.
The subject came up during the state's Finance Advisory Committee meeting. The group was discussing issues that affect tax collections when Georgiana Meyer, the former chief economist for the Department of Revenue, spoke about the cuts, saying the state could lose anywhere between $50 and $100 million a year.
There basically is no longer any corporate audit activity at the Department of Revenue, and that's going to have a significant impact on any enforcement revenues.
A spokesman for Governor Doug Ducey acknowledged the staffing cuts, but added that tax collections are up, though that was before the layoffs. Still, he contends fewer people will not lead to less oversight. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Spain every year, dozens of town festivals are held in which bulls and other animals are taunted and killed by locals as part of the festivities. In recent years, the most famous or infamous of these has been the Toro de la Vega Festival, held every September in northern Spain. But this year, a new law says the animal could not be harmed. The BBC's Guy Hedgecoe reports.
This protest, held in Tordesillas on the same morning as this year's fiesta, is against the new law. Many of these people have grown up with the tradition of Toro de la Vega, which they say dates back to the 16th century.
There's a real air of expectation now as the people of Tordesillas line the streets as they wait for the bull to be released. There's quite a big police presence here around the town and just outside it to make sure that that new regulation is enforced. There are six police on horseback right next to me as I speak.
The bull is released and it gallops out of the town, past local people who line the streets, and runs into the fields beyond, where men on horseback are waiting to pursue it.
Now running with a large group of young men after the bull. It's hard to see it because there's a huge cloud of dust lifted by the horse riders who are pursuing it as well. And it's run into a field quite far outside the town itself.
We eventually catch up with the bull. It's guided back towards the town and the fiesta comes to an end. Nobody's been hurt and the new law has been respected. For the first time in centuries, the bull hasn't been speared and killed. That change has coincided with and been influenced by the arrival of a generation of young politicians on the left, many of them members of the new Podemos party. Here is Podemos leader Pablo Iglesias talking about the issue a few weeks ago.
We have to ban the fiestas in which animals are mistreated, such as Toro de la Vega, and for example in the town of Benavente, where they set light to the bull's horns. All of this has to be outlawed. As for bullfights, I think that they should not receive subsidies, and also that there should be referendums in each town so as to allow society to change without prohibition by decree. In the Canary Islands, there are not bullfights because the people don't want them. And I think as time goes by, there are more and more places where people don't want bullfights.
But it's not just politicians who are campaigning on this issue. I'm at an animal rights demonstration in central Madrid, the biggest that Spain has seen in recent years. And it seems to reflect a growing support for animal rights on the part of ordinary Spaniards. All around me, there are thousands of people chanting and holding out banners, calling for the end of bullfighting and the end of all those town fiestas in which animals are harmed and killed.
Many of those here believe that parties like Podemos need to be even more strident in their stance. Claudia Mañas is a member of the PACMA Animal Rights Party.
Banning Toro de la Vega was a great victory, but just the first step in a long way we have to walk, and it ends with the abolition of every single fiesta that tortures animals.
Claudia Mañas there speaking to the BBC's Guy Hedgeco.
Whether it's the Fitbit or an Apple Watch or any number of devices we put on our wrists to tell time or measure our steps or give us emails and voicemail messages, our lives have been changed by wearable technology. Now a Phoenix-based company called Somatics Lab has come up with what they consider to be an evolution of that kind of technology. It's called Moment, another device you'd wear on your wrist, but it's completely designed for the sense of touch. To learn more about it, I'm joined by Shantanu Bala, Jake Rockland, and Ajay Kharpur of Somatics Lab. Shantanu, for those of us who are most familiar with items like Fitbit or the Apple Watch on our wrists, what makes Moment different?
So there's a lot of devices on the market that tell you when something has happened. So even your cell phone, it vibrates to tell you that an incoming phone call is currently coming in or that there's a message that you've just received. But you don't really get any sense of what has actually happened. And that's the thing that's, still missing from the marketplace and something that we've looked around and, you know, initially when we were thinking up of what we could make, we thought that that was the critical piece that was missing, is communicating what's happening around you through your sense of touch.
What is it that attracts you to this sort of thing? And what do you think attracts the general populace to this sort of thing? Why has this caught fire as it has?
I think one of the things that's most attractive to me and to a lot of the people who've shown early interest in our device is just the ability to stay connected to the digital world, stay connected to the people who are important to you, who you may not be interacting with in person on a day-to-day basis, but you're interacting with every day. Being able to stay close to them without being constantly attached to a screen is something that is not possible right now with other devices on the market, but something that we allow you to do. That's something that I think is going to become more and more attractive to people, especially as we're constantly inundated with more and more notifications from different applications and things like that. Being able to shut those off and only obtain the things that are most important to us, I think that's something that has a lot of appeal.
Also, I think there's also considerable benefit to having the information you need come in through a different modality, so to speak. If the way you interact with the world around you is visual and auditory, to take out a screen and have to look at it and interrupt what you're doing, where you are, is something that we see a lot of opportunity to improve upon.
So how do we get people into the mode of feeling like it's okay to have, like, the touch is a positive thing as opposed to something questionable? I mean, is that something philosophically you guys thought about at all?
Definitely. So a lot of the trends you see with technology nowadays involve more and more technologies that we wear on our bodies, or technologies that we're carrying with us all the time. And we asked ourselves the question, if we're wearing technologies or if we're carrying them on our bodies, what does the body do best? And the body feels information. It's feeling the surrounding temperature. It's feeling the textures of the things that you touch. And all of those small details are constantly being received and interpreted by your brain. And we can communicate information through touch very much in the same way that you communicate information through sight. But if we're putting electronics on our bodies, why not do what the body does best?
Mm. Touch for many people implies intimacy, at least it has in many ways. You know, human touch to touch is a certain feeling that we get, whether it's someone you love or whether it's a baby or whether it's petting a dog or whatever it is. There's that touch, which is a different sort of thing. It's almost like a comfort level. And yet what we're talking about here is a different kind of touch, maybe just as important, but different. Is that adaptable as well to make it so that that touch is almost as fond and as comfortable as the touch we have with other human beings?
Yeah, so there's an entire field within haptics, the science of touch, called affective haptics, and that's precisely about evoking certain emotions with different types of stimulus through touch. And there's a lot of that we've designed into the kind of touch cues that we convey.
Back when I was working at the Center for Cognitive Ubiquitous Computing at Arizona State University, there was an experiment we were running where we were trying to see whether you can communicate the basic emotions, so things like happiness, anger, surprise, fear, and so on, entirely through sensations that you'd feel on your back. And it's interesting just how intuitive those sensations can be. So if you feel kind of a shiver running up and down your spine, it's very obvious that it's gonna feel really strange and unsettling. And that's the type of sensation and also intuition that we can tap into when you're communicating details entirely through touch.
So let's talk about what Moment is. What does it look like at this point?
Physically, Moment is designed to be in a form factor that people are somewhat used to already, being something that you wear on your wrist. But unlike devices on the market or devices you'd be used to, even like a normal wristwatch, there's no real face to the device, or I should say like the face is a very clean design that has just a single LED, kind of displays basic information about the functionality of the device. But really the device doesn't need a screen because it's been designed to communicate entirely through your sense of touch. And when you see it, it's initially can be a little bit visually startling. It's something that's very unique. And that's very intentional.
What's the point? What is going to make Moment something that will affect people's lives in a positive way? I mean, what is the dynamic involved?
Devices like Fitbit, they're fitness trackers that kind of collect data about what you're doing, but aren't really a form of interaction. We see Moment as the first step towards a new way to interact with technology. It's a new form of interaction. I think that's something that has like pretty far-reaching implications. I guess Moment is the first device that will communicate information entirely through the sense of touch, and for that reason serves as a platform for people to build a lot of things on top of that. So some of the first things we're building for it are turn-by-turn GPS directions. So as you're driving and you have a left turn coming up, you'll feel a sensation moving towards the left on your skin, and that takes away the need to like listen to a GPS or watch it while you're driving, which can be distracting and somewhat dangerous. Musicians can use a metronome and feel the pulse on their skin, so that way they're not trying to listen to a click track while they're playing. You can get caller ID invisibly, you know, without having to take out your phone.
And at the same time, the device as a whole is really just about situational awareness, where going back to, you know, whether it's a metronome for a musician or a GPS while driving, you have things that are adding to the experience of doing what someone enjoys. So if you're trying to navigate to a new place or if you're trying to play an instrument, the bits of information that you're getting are all adding to your experience and making you more aware of what you're doing rather than distracting you from it.
Shantanu Bala, Jake Rockland, and Ajay Karpur with the Valley-based Somatics Lab. We've been talking about their wrist-worn Moment device.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. In Phoenix, I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, the Cactus Road exit ramp is restricted. Also, watch out for a crash on the 101 southbound at Broadway. That has traffic slow in that area. And on the 10 westbound, a crash blocks the shoulder at Baseline. Sunny skies in the valley forecast for today with a high of 90. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-60s, warming up to 95 tomorrow. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, 88 degrees at KJZZ at 2:55.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing Steak Lovers, with a selection of USDA Prime and USDA Choice steaks, including New York strips, ribeyes, and cowboy style. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
A two-mile stretch in Tucson is considered one of the most endangered historic places in the country. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has added the city's Sunshine Mile to that list. The announcement comes in the midst of Tucson's Modernism Week. Joining me to talk about this part of town and why it's threatened is Damian Klinko, Executive Director of the Tucson Historic Preservation Foundation. And Damian, what's the significance of having Sunshine Mile on this list?
The Sunshine Mile is part of Broadway Boulevard in Tucson, Arizona, and it's a two-mile stretch that runs between Country Club and Euclid, and along the alignment are dozens of mid-century modern storefronts that were built in the post-World War II era in Tucson. A widening project that was conceived in the 1980s and was funded through our Regional Transportation Authority is going to widen the roadway from 4 to 6 lanes, and is going to impact dozens of buildings and will result in the loss of numerous historic buildings along the corridor. So because of the scope of this project and because of how many buildings are being impacted, the National Trust for Historic Preservation named Broadway Boulevard one of the 11 most endangered places in America.
Do you think that will have any bearing on how that widening project goes forward?
Well, our hope is that there really are some solutions that are really based in land use and being proactive in dealing with historic preservation, rather than waiting till after the roadway is completed to really embrace some land use planning efforts now could really result in the preservation of many of these buildings and ensure that Tucson's tax base is really remains intact and isn't lost. So by being very proactive in the approach, we think that there's actually a solution here that could result in retaining that sense of place and that sense of mid-century corridor.
Are these buildings generally occupied now?
Yeah, most of the buildings are occupied. This roadway project was conceived in 1984 as part of a major streets and routes plan. And so since 1984, there has been a reluctance from property owners to invest into their properties because there was an anticipation of the road being widened and these buildings being acquired and the buildings being torn down. So in a way, that policy has created sort of preservation by neglect because there hasn't been renewed energy or resources invested into remodeling the facades.
When you look at buildings and areas with buildings of that era in Tucson, where does this particular stretch fall? Like, is this sort of the prime location for mid-century buildings in Tucson?
Yeah, this is the largest concentration of mid-century modern commercial storefront architecture in our city. Now, Tucson went through, like many places in the Southwest, went through a huge transformation in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s after World War II. And that transformational period of growth really defines that era. And the architecture expresses this post-war optimism. So you had everything from clothing stores to automobile dealerships along Broadway, all catering to this new American phenomenon of suburbanization.
This era of architecture and other forms of design really seem to have captured the imagination of a lot of folks, especially people in Phoenix, where there are many efforts to try to preserve mid-century type buildings. Is that the case in Tucson as well?
Yeah, I think that's starting to occur here. The Tucson Historic Preservation Foundation, 5 years ago, we launched the first Tucson Modernism Week. Popular culture has, I think, informs how the public generally feels and thinks about this type of architecture. And these corridors and these buildings, particularly in the Southwest, because this was our boom period, because of our weather, because of the economic conditions that have sort of existed in the late 20th century, we still have a huge concentration all over the state of these wonderful mid-century modern resources. These buildings have economic viability. And, in Tucson, many of these buildings are they're small storefronts, and so they're perfect for incubator spaces and for the development of small businesses, and can really give back to our community's tax base. So we see it as a win-win if we can preserve these buildings, create economic activity that supports our community's general fund, and at the same time preserve these remarkable gems.
Damian Klinko is the executive director of the Tucson Historic Preservation Foundation. Damian, thanks.
Thank you.
That'll do it for today's edition of the show. Be sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2. We'll hear about fears about the potential future uses of artificial intelligence and all that jazz. What's its future? That and more tomorrow at 2 on the show.
And no doubt you're very busy tonight, but if you have time to see the star of Biodome, that's our highlight for tonight, Mark.
How can you not?
Pauly Shore is going to be at the Tempe Improv tonight.
You'll be there, right?
At 8. Well, I may be, I may not be, but take a look. The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shedd and Mariana Dale are our digital team. The managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director is Al Macias. And our executive producer is John Hoban. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. You can find us at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is KJZZ FM Phoenix in HD. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.